If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Starobin, and welcome to America and Beyond on the New Books Network. I'm pleased to have today as my guests authors John B. Judas and Roy Teixeira, authors of Where Have All the Democrats Gone? John serves as the editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo. Previously, he worked as a senior writer at the National Journal and a senior editor at the New Republic. His past books include The Emerging Democratic Majority, which he co-wrote with Roy, as well as The Populist Explosion and the Paradox of American Democracy. Roy's a contributing columnist of the Washington Post. He's co-founder and politics editor of the Liberal Patriot Newsletter and a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Glad to have you. And you need to also plug my book on Israel and Truman, Genesis. I'm trying to get the sales these days.
Right, it's... Of pertinence.
I see. Well, we can possibly address that later. But in the first instance, this emerging Democratic majority book was published in 2002. So here we are now, 21 years later. There's a thread, as your book shows, that connects that book to Where Have All the Democrats Gone? How would you describe that thread?
Go ahead, Rui.
Okay. The thread that connects them, I suppose, is trying to understand how American politics was and is changing. So at the time we wrote Emerging Democratic Majority, we were looking at the way some of the tectonic plates of American politics were shifting. Increasing role of non-white voters, of course, but also the rise of professionals or influence in the Democratic Party, the rise of cosmopolitan metropolitan areas, we called ideopolises, the role of women. There were a number of changes taking place that all seemed to be shifting politics in a direction that was congenial for the Democrats, who allowed them to form, you know, a sort of successor majority coalition to the New Deal coalition, if they played their cards right. And it all depended on them continuing to be a party that could potentially appeal to not only all the different prongs of this or parts of this emerging coalition, but also, importantly, a very significant minority share of what used to be one of their big strengths, which is a white working class, particularly looms important in a lot of key states that Democrats had controlled for a number of years and were key to their coalition. So what happened over time, and why we wrote this book, is try to understand, well, what happened to that majority coalition that seemed to be coming into being, particularly with Obama's 2008 victory? How did we get to where we are today?
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is I mean, this kind of you, un,
right,
unstable
you say
coalition
you got
between
some,
the parties.
Right. In the book, you explicitly say there's a section, you know, what we got wrong.
Right. So one thing, you know, I mean, there's a number of things we say in there, but in terms of raw political impact, I think the key thing we got wrong is we didn't really anticipate the extent to which white working class voters could continue to be even more alienated from the Democratic Party, that in fact they would not make, you know, much of an effort to keep these voters, that after 2012 they decide with Obama's second victory that the future lies with the rising American electorate, and we just have to double and triple down on that. We don't need to worry about these voters who are drifting away from us, who are white and are working class, because they're all closet racists and reactionaries. Anyway, so that was a key part of what happened. And I think linked to that, we did not anticipate how shadow party dominated by these professionals would become, and the ways in which they would pick up on a lot of these social issues and push the Democrats in a direction that was very liberal, if not radical, on a lot of these issues. And that would come to dominate the party and its associated institutions.
We'll talk more about the shadow party.
I think another way to put it, Paul, is that as I remember the past, I used to tell Rui, well, we're going to lose West Virginia, but we're going to win Virginia because of the Northern Virginia suburbs. And in fact, you know, I don't think the Democrats will win West Virginia back because of climate change policies, but I don't think we understood the degree to which we would lose, as Democrats, small towns, mid-sized towns that depended upon mining and manufacturing. I mean, I think that that's, again, if you can look at the problem either in terms of class or region, and the Democrats have just gotten killed in those areas. And that has made up to some extent for the advances they've made in these big metro areas with finance and education and high tech and all that stuff. So that's the, I think that's the other part of the emerging Democratic majority that we missed, that we didn't.
Right. And the first part of the book, Paul, The Great Divide, is all about that, those developments of region and class, which bifurcated the Democrats' coalition and essentially canceled out their increasing strength in sort of ideopolises and states that in which those ideopolises loom large.
Yeah. Well, and not to make this too much of a love fest, because I did enjoy the book and recommend it to everyone, but I find it refreshing that you are willing to go back and say, yeah, this is what we got wrong, because that is not, you know, your everyday event in sort of, you know, among analysts of politics or of any other discipline or field. So I think that's a healthy thing, and I wish more people would do that. I want to zoom in on this concept or construct of the shadow party. John, I thought I detected a note of John Judas in the identification of the shadow party as a kind of vanguard. Perhaps I'm wrong there, but I associate that term, somehow Lenin or somebody, Trotsky, somebody like that always seems to come into focus, a vanguard. It almost sounds like a very European.
And I'm an ex-commie too, so it's both of us.
All right, I'm talking to two ex-commies. I'm not an ex-commie, but I have spent all too much time reading about vanguards in the context of the Russian Revolution and so forth. But I think that construct is certainly going to get attention from readers of your book, and they may be in some way unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, well, yes. I just a note here that Rui and I met, like 50 years ago, and he was wearing a Mao cap at the time. So
goodness,
power to Vanguard, the people, baby.
Yeah, Vanguard is not just my.
Okay, I thought it. Well, I know you, John, better than I know Rui, so that maybe is my bad.
So, I guess what we were thinking of is something like this, that if you analyze parties prior to, let's say, the late 1990s, you really just can make this distinction between a governing coalition that in the parties, both parties, was a lot of which was based in the Eastern Seaboard in all these institutions, including the AFL-CIO, not just business, but major business lobbies, Council on Foreign Relations, groups like that. And that constitutes the kind of governing coalition from which the parties draw their secretaries of this and assistant secretaries of that, and from which a lot of their policies emanate. Bill Clinton, you know, people were he was talking about, you know, putting people first and all that stuff. And then Bob Rubin ends up as the central character.
Yes.
Of Goldman Sachs and his administration.
And yeah, that Goldman Sachs.
Reflects the mm-hmm. governing council. And then you have a big electoral coalition that the party tries to appeal to so that, you know, you can sort of split it that way. And that's the kind of thing that Bill Domhoff used to talk about in Who Rules America and the C, right? Bill's talked about. Now, I think that really starts to change in the late 1990s. And a lot of it's the influence of the internet and the way in which information is now dispersed throughout the country. The political discussion itself changes. And these, again, activist groups, foundations, organizations, lobbies come to have an inordinate influence on public discussion. It's no longer confined to, you know, like a handful of groups in the Eastern Seaboard. And within the Democratic Party, the dominant groups come out of this professionals within the high tech, higher education, metro areas, and college towns. And they put forward a politics that, especially on social issues, is more radical than most of the country. Where, you know, the example I always use is that how many people outside a few zip codes can identify what all the initials in LGBTQIA+ mean? They can't. Or who would use a term like Latinx. But this comes the common vocabulary itself of this kind of shadow party within the Democrats. So in an election in 2020, very few Democrats for federal office actually use a term like defund the police. I mean, they wouldn't do it because they don't agree with it. But yet the party itself becomes linked to that through this shadow party.
Right. And in your introduction of this construct, this concept as the vanguard of the college educated professionals in the post-industrial metro centers, you also refer to an aura of moral censoriousness, of neo-Puritan religiosity that surrounds much of the Democrats' shadow party groups. And in the illustrative chapters that follow later in the book, having to do in particular with race and radicalism and climate change, you continue on that theme. I thought that was interesting. For example, climate, you write of a millenarian quasi-religious stance. With regard to race, you quote John McWhorter, his phrase, an anti-racist fervor among young whites, quote, the new birth of a new religion. So I felt like I actually wanted to hear more on that, but maybe now, I mean, where does a quasi-religious Puritan impulse come from? I mean,
that is more my shtick. The Vanguard.
All right, that's your shtick. But okay, but just to clear my throat, a little bit on it.
I wonder if your listeners have read the David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed. That's the classic.
I think that we can guarantee almost none of them have read it. It's an extremely long book.
We should never assume anything. But they are familiar with this the Puritan part, I think, anyway, yes. Of this, and
well,
I think.
What he tries to show is how these different ideological religious strains come out of different parts of the emigres from England, Scotland, and Ireland. And the Puritan strain is very important in New England, and it becomes a kind of ideology of a certain part of the northern part of the country in the United States. And it pops up in all these places when you have a left wingers, for instance. They talk about this was during the 60s. They conceive themselves as a kind of chosen, as an elite, as the elect, again, a concept that comes out of Puritanism, Congregationalism, and they, again, the sense of mission. So that's very important, again, to a certain ideological strain in America. And it's often contrasted to the Scots-Irish and the Jacksonians and the Southern politics, which is very different. But that, that again, that Puritan strain, I think, runs through a lot of the history of the left. And, you know, particularly the left, even after the after the 30s and 40s and 50s, when it becomes in the 60s, again, a kind of rooted in college towns and big metro centers in the north, you get this kind of political outlook. And, you know, Rui can talk about this. It's, you know, it's so clear in the apocalyptic strain in climate change.
Yeah, the millenarian.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, we stress in the book, and I think most people would agree with this. I mean, climate change is a real problem. Racism is a real problem. Discrimination against trans people is a real problem. But you can be concerned about these problems and want to do something about it, and not necessarily embrace, you know, for example, in terms of climate, the need to ban electric vehicles and go to net zero by 2030 or 40 or 50, and sort of an impractical approach to getting industrial societies completely off of fossil fuels, rather than wind, solar. That's almost millenarian commitment. But what you have with something like that is, you know, it's not enough to be, you know, concerned about climate change and want to do something about it. If you don't embrace the full panoply of this sort of apocalyptic approach and policy commitments, you're on the wrong side. You're not part of the elect. You're sort of cast out. And I think you see the same thing with the racism issue. People could, to say you're opposed to racism is not enough. I mean, you have to embrace a whole vector of things around, you know, white privilege, around microaggressions, around how racism imbricates every aspect of American life, how we're actually a white supremacist society, and so on. And if you don't embrace that, then again, you're not part of the elect, and so on down the line. I mean, you basically take real problems, real concerns people have, and then you sort of transmute them into this catechism that everyone has to embrace. And if they do not, they're not part of the elect.
Well, is there a counterpart here to the what's happening sort of on the Republican conservatives? I mean, I just read an interesting piece the other day. It was an essay by Damon Linker that ran in the New York Times about this trend towards sort of catastrophe-ism, something like that, among conservative thinkers of a certain kind. But again, this notion of, you know, the apocalypse and so forth. I mean, is this a, you know, is this part of the polarization where the Democrats have essentially their own brand or strain, or the left
own brand of apocalypse?
Well,
right,
yeah. You know, it occurs. It seems like it's very much part of our conversation. But again, I think it's important to note that it doesn't seem to be gripping like the majority of the population. But among so-called thinkers or people who focus on this sort of thing, it does seem to be pretty resonant.
Yeah. Well, the part of the Puritan idea was, again, the book. The Bible as a key guide to life. And I remember being in Arizona at a rally that the religious right people were calling on behalf of McCain at that time, and Palin was speaking, and the Tea Party people were passing out little constitutions in the same way as people on the left used to pass out the Mao's Red Book. It was the same thing. I mean, the Constitution, again, becomes reified into this special kind of book that if you really understand it, it will be a guide to life. And, you know, this guy Michael Johnson comes out of
some
of that same history. Where there's a guy, I think his name is Brady. I used to follow all this stuff and go to the conventions. Has this theory of American history and of the Revolution and of the Constitution, that it really does, and it really does merge church and state after all. And so anyway, the book, A Special Interpretation, all that again comes out of the religious past,
right?
The Protestantism.
And I think I also was thinking, as I read about the Shouter Party and how it kind of works as a construct when you're talking about race, religion, immigration, also important in climate. But then with respect to, for example, to abortion and abortion rights, it seems like there's a harmony there between this shadow party conviction and where the party, more broadly speaking, is, right?
Well, there's a harmony, in the current political context, right? Because when the Dobbs decision comes down and the pro-life forces within the Republican Party are unleashed to try to push things, you know, in states that are, you know, almost total bans or 6-week limits and so on, which is quite extreme by the standards of the American voter, it redounds totally to the benefit of the Democrats, because it's the Republicans who seem extreme and to have commitments that are way outside the boundaries of what most people want. But it's also the case that if you sort of dig down into what the shadow party of the Democrats really wants, clearly what they want is unrestricted abortion, basically available at any time for any reason throughout pregnancy. That is
the House voted, right? Remember,
the House voted basically in favor of that. So, but most people aren't aware of that, and they won't be aware of it until the Republicans sort of manage to neutralize the issue somewhat, and they're already trying to do so. But the shadow party, if in fact their position does come into focus, it will be yet another problem for the Democrats along these lines, because people, it's very clear from the data, the median voter in the United States would be perfectly happy with like 15 or 20 month limit on abortion with exceptions thereafter.
Right. Well, what about on Israel and Gaza? I mean, I know that's all reignited after your book was, after your book was written, certainly. Is there a shadow party element there in terms of where the shadow party might view this conflict and related issues that kind of go to whether it's Islamophobia or anti-Semitism, issues we see now on college campuses with respect to those problems. Is there a difference there, you know, in terms of the shadow party mindset and where they would like to go, and broadly speaking, Democratic voters?
Yeah, this could take us for the rest of the 45 minutes.
Yeah, we'll try to keep it
short. And wouldn't necessarily...
We're talking, I should make clear, you know, on November the 6th, 2023, where this issue is kind of dominating global headlines.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, it used to be that the Democrats and liberal Democrats were the leaders in the sort of quote pro-Israel movement. I mean, the head of the of AIPAC, who really saw it to its strength, was a former Kennedy staffer, Ted Kennedy staffer. So it used to be the Democratic issue, and it used to be, in that case, it was really Israel, right or wrong. That's completely changed in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, the board of AIPAC is mostly Republicans, not Democrats now. And the most militant supporters of Israel are, you'll find, in the Republican coalition. Democrats more split, older Democrats less inclined to criticize Israel, younger Democrats more inclined. In this case, what you have is a small subset of younger Democrats who have again, extreme views on Israel-Palestine that are similar to those we talk about in the book and on immigration or climate change and race, where they really are, some of them applauding what Hamas did, but at the least not ignoring or discounting that. While calling on the Israelis to accommodate the Palestinians. So, I mean, on the one hand, I agree with a lot of the things, the ceasefire and stuff like that, but the not recognizing the kind of atrocities that Hamas performed is very characteristic of this, again, this pretty small subset that's making a lot of noise. And it's
being... Yeah, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, as John's pointing out, it's clearly highly contested within the Democratic Party. But I do think the connection to the shadow party is kind of important, because if you look at least the activist groups and a lot of the nonprofits and so on, you do see this melding of issues around race, immigration, climate and even Palestine, right, sort of put together into one blob of left positions that must be held by all the people who are right thinking and are on the right side of history. And we've seen Free Palestine stuff creep into a lot of these organizations. One of my favorite recent photos is a picture of Greta Thunberg and some of her supporters, you know, her activist friends, holding up signs both about climate justice and about Free Palestine. So that the things have become kind of pushed together in the minds of a lot of these activists who do loom large in the shadow party, and a lot of organizations that are part of that shadow party becoming increasingly leaning in that direction. And I think that pushes them to take some stances in the context of the current conflict that are, you know, highly questionable
Well, we see, you know, I mean, a connection was made explicit. You mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates in your chapter on race and his
great example,
iconic article about, you know, reparations and so forth. His book that went deeper into all of that. So he was recently in Palestine. I just caught kind of a snippet of this, and he was on the West Bank, and he said the first thing that came immediately to his mind was the conditions of the Palestinians in the West Bank, in analogy to the conditions of Black people in, you know, segregated America, essentially. I mean, that was, you know, that was his construct. So it seems like, you know, the kind of identity that you're talking about among these issues is really quite strongly felt.
Yeah, although I agree with that. On Coates, with that particular, I think there are analogies both with Jim Crow America and with South Africa, if you look at the conditions.
Yeah.
You're asking us about the politics. On the actual issues, I really liked what Obama had to say about it, which is being widely, you know, condemned, but nobody has clean hands.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as you say, we could probably do the rest of the podcast on it. So let's not, although I'll come back a little bit later with a more of a conclusory type question I have about the shadow party, but let's get back to the sort of the core theme. Where have the Democrats gone? Which is the answer to that has a lot to do with the defection of the white working class voter, and you sketch that out in ways that, you know, I don't see how people can really challenge it. They can discuss the why of it, but the facts and evidence certainly seem clear. So I'm looking at today's New York Times, the print edition. I'm an old-fashioned guy. I like to wake up to my New York Times. And it's always significant what the editors decide is the most important story. And today it was voters in five battlegrounds favor Trump over Biden. Presidential preference, this will be for you, Roy. In Nevada, the presidential preference in swing states, as of today, it's a snapshot. We know all that. Nevada, plus 10, Trump. Georgia, plus 6, Trump. Arizona, plus 5, Trump. Michigan, plus 5, Trump. Pennsylvania, plus 4, Trump. Wisconsin, plus 2, Biden. And I read somewhere that this could come down to like 300 electoral votes for the president, ex-president Trump, with the election held today. So he's got a kind of comfortable margin. Now, the twist here, and I'll let you talk, but it struck me, the twist here reading deeper into this was it's also showing a kind of bleeding away from Biden among Black voters and Hispanic voters.
And so, young voters.
So maybe makes it a little, you know, there's some twist here. But how does that polling snapshot fit into your core, you know, concept in the book?
Well, in the book, I mean, we do go into some detail talking about, obviously, the evolution of the white working class away from the Democratic Party and the reasons for that. But we also then follow on by talking about the way in which Democrats are starting to lose the loyalties of non-white, particularly Hispanic working class voters, and how that's manifested itself in recent elections. And so we're very much seeing this in this latest spate of polls for the New York Times. If you look at the margins, for example, the Democrats have among Hispanics in the states where they break it out, you know, they're sometimes even tied, or if the margins they get are like in the single digits or maybe 10 points, that's terrible for Democrats. If you look at, you know, one thing I like to do when they provide the breaks is look at the difference between non-college or working class voters and college educated voters as a whole. And we're now seeing this over and over again. There's a complete inversion of the Democrats' performance among these two groups. Among, you know, working class voters, they'll be down like 20 points or 15 points. Among college educated voters, they'll be up 15 or 20 points. This is really remarkable and really, in a sense, defines where American politics is today and what the party's respective bases are. And as John was mentioning also, I mean, probably the latest version of demographics is destiny, since the non-white thing seems to be going south of the Democrats. And there's some awareness of it is like, oh, the young people will save us. These rising generations, Gen Z, the millennials, whatever comes after them, you know, sort of the cohorts of new generations, which are more liberal, will push aside the oldsters and everything will be great. Well, that assumes, of course, that young voters, younger generation voters, are sort of impervious to the appeal of Republicans and will stay with the Democrats at exactly the same margins that they have had previously. And what these polls show is that's kind of a dicey assumption. The margins Democrats have among young voters in a lot of these states are terrible. And in fact, some, they're not even positive margins, they're negative margins, where they're actually losing the vote. So this, I think, just all underscores, you know, from our perspective, the way Democrats have assumed that these rising groups, and particularly working class members of these rising groups, would stick with them no matter what, despite how the Democrats have become identified with, you know, things that I think a lot of these voters aren't enthusiastic about.
I mean, are the young voters apathetic? Are they, is it just that they're just not as interested in the whole Trump is about to destroy, you know, the foundations of American democracy?
Well, clearly they're not as moved by that as Democrats hope they will be. Instead, they seem to be affected by the economy, how their lives are going under Biden as opposed to under Trump, their general sense of social disorder and things not going in the right direction. They're very, you know, sort of responsive to these things, the prices of homes, the prices of cars. You know, Democrats, I think, have assumed that, you know, gosh, I mean, we're for abortion rights and the other side's trying to destroy democracy. Of course, all these groovy young people will be for us, but they live in the real world. And, you know, the appeal of Democrats and along these a lot of these lines is very suspect for them, and they're willing to look in other directions.
Well, that would be, John, I'll let you get in a second, but I just want to add that would be an example in my mind of how there are real consequences to the shadow party's sort of, you know, misunderstanding in a kind of deep way of important segments of the electorate.
I think that there's another element to it that I've been trying to work out myself. And it goes back to Weber, the idea of charisma among leaders. Freud, group psychology, and the analysis.
Here he goes.
Shut your yaps.
All aboard. Did you know Max Weber?
No. nation, again, as an extension psychologically of the family, the ruler as a president, as a father. Our special constitution, which bestows upon the president some of the role of king as well as prime minister, or you know, if you don't touchy about it, queen and prime minister.
Yeah.
So that there is a kind of psychological expectation of the president is either good father or bad father. Trump in 2020, very much the bad father. Biden simply not living up to that role, especially among the young. And that's a respect in which it's not just his age, because Trump is, you know, what, 78? I mean, it's the same
77,
age,
but, I believe, yeah.
But he lacks dynamism. He lacks, he's not even the grandfather. He's the grandfather who you sort of put up at the table because he's kind of weird. He doesn't talk right. And
we know.
I think that's an underrated element, especially among young voters, of their disenchantment with Biden. I don't know whether it's going to carry out to other Democratic candidates. Also, I think black males and Hispanic males, again, looking at the comparison of Biden and Trump, I think that that's a, I think that that's again an underlying factor. So
yeah,
that's my, well, besides the economy, besides.
Yeah. Well,
right. I think the question of leadership does loom large, and whether one puts it in a good father, bad father context. I mean, if you're a young person, who do you want leading you into the future? I don't think Biden quite fills the bill.
Yeah, but the question will be whether the election, if Trump is the nominee, will be fought over, you know, the bad father or the good father, to put it. I mean, whether if it's again like 2020, then the Democrats will eke it out again, I think.
Yeah.
If it's over Biden, I mean, the Democrats are in big trouble.
Right.
Yeah, well, just to bar the door.
Just a note, I mean, we may have this complicating factor of, you know, of independent or third party candidates with.
That doesn't help either, because, I mean, again, I think that's key to Robert Kennedy Jr.'s appeal among young voters. Dynamic, young Kennedy. I mean, I don't give a damn about the vaccine stuff or the fact that he's a kook. You know, it's again, I think that's part of his attraction.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll see if he can get on the ballots as well.
Yeah. Let's hope not.
One point with the Hispanic voter that comes out in the book is on the issue of immigration. They do seem to see things in terms of authorized legal immigration and illegal immigration. And that also seems to surprise a lot of people in this sort of shadow party, because they don't quite seem to understand. And I often hear that just on my sort of Facebook page, which is mostly about current events, I often hear people say, you know, Trump, his only source of appeal is to this kind of white nationalist kind of base. So they don't even seem to admit into the discussion that on an issue on immigration in particular, it's not that simple.
Yeah, I mean, to put it in somewhat impolitely, this is just complete baloney. And anyone who paid a little attention to the data or ever listened to what actually Hispanic voters had to say would know this isn't true. One of the big mistakes the Democrats made relative to the Hispanic population is during the teens, they basically, well, it predates that to some extent, but really sort of honed in on this idea. Hispanics are people of color. They are concerned about the fact they're non-whites in a white society. And they absolutely are, you know, sort of 100% committed to basically easy immigration. Immigration is the key policy for them. That's what they care about. So we must be four square for liberalized immigration and send the message that, you know, it's like people should be able to come to the United States if they want. And we should basically try to legalize the people who are here. And we shouldn't worry too much about border security because that's draconian and mean. And this does not go down well with actual Hispanics who actually vote. I was listening to a focus group of swing Hispanic voters the other day on a podcast, and it was really remarkable what a lot of these voters were saying. It's like, I don't understand why these people are, you know, we're letting these people in. If you're going to come here, you should do it the right way. You know, I go into New York City. I live in the suburbs, and the migrants are all over the place. And this is terrible. This is like disorderly, and, you know, this puts a burden on resources. And they were, you know, they sounded like Trump voters, and maybe some of them will become Trump voters in this coming election. But the idea that Hispanics are committed to the immigration regime the Biden administration has either, you know, sort of intentionally, unintentionally implemented is just incorrect. And then we have twin to that, the role of immigration overall is an issue that drives Trumpian populism. I mean, because of this commitment to not caring that much about border security, not trying to fix a broken asylum system, and so on and so forth, it hands an issue to the Trumpian populace that has huge appeal, obviously, as we were just discussing, among Hispanics, but also among the broad working class and other populations of the United States for whom the idea that borders should be quasi-open is like anathema. So this is bad in so many ways. It's bad for the Democrats among voters as a whole. It's bad for Democrats among Hispanic voters in particular. And it's going to be a real problem, I think, going into this next election.
I mean, not to be a minor, but do you think that Joe Biden and his sort of heart of hearts, you know, the guy from Scranton, you know, gets that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm always willing to grant the idea Joe Biden has better instincts than a lot of the people who advise him. And he is does come from a different political and cultural milieu. But once you've said and done things long enough and you're surrounded by people who all say the same thing and your staffers all lean in a certain direction and you're kind of guy like Joe Biden is, who's very sensitive to the currents that are blowing through the party and is not really a profile in courage. I think after a while you start to believe what you're saying or what you're not saying.
I guess it amounts to the same thing.
Our immigration policy is great. You know, we can't possibly move in a direction of being more strict at the border because that would be cruel and inhumane. I mean, look at his position on trans issues, how it's evolved.
Yeah, we're going
to
get to that.
10 years ago, Biden would have nothing to say about trans issues, and now it's the civil rights issue of our time. So whether his instincts are better than his staff, granted, but I think over time he's absorbed a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, well, actually, let's just pivot to something we haven't talked about, which is this chapter called sexual creationism, which I believe John Judas is responsible for as a matter of
terminology. Are you going to get me canceled now?
I want to. Well, let's see if we can. Not on this.
It was all Rui. I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, not on this podcast. But what the hell are you talking about? I mean, where does that come from?
Well, it's a play upon the denial of the theory of evolution by fundamentalists and the creation of a theory of evolution called creationism that's basically just kooky science. And again, our view, not of the rights of transgender people to be free from discrimination, but of the transgender ideology, pregnant people, you know, somebody who identifies a man who identifies as a woman is a woman, period, and you know, should have all the rights, including playing in competitive sports and what have you. That reflects again a gender ideology, and the ideology itself is like creationism. It runs counter to biology. It runs counter to the theory of evolution. And it's kooky, but it dominates again a certain strain of politics within this shadow party.
Well, let me push a little bit against kooky though, because you know, in your other chapters, you're again this sort of neo-Puritanism theme. This, you know, I mean, is there some deeper well from which this can be drawn that connects to that idea about the sort of religious or quasi-religious element?
Oh, you love that stuff. I know.
I do. I think it's very interesting. And I'll just say to everyone listening, John and I sometimes disagree about this. I'm an absolute huge believer in the idea that a religious disposition runs deeply into humankind. And if it's not expressed in a kind of organized religion or conventional religion way, it comes out in other forms. I mean, I think climate change is environmentalism in a radical way is the most obvious example of that. But I think it can come out in other forms as well. I was just really finding myself scratching my head a little bit about, you know, the sexual creationism and what you just described. I mean, you know, let's just be honest.
It's a good question.
I'm 66 years old.
Yeah.
I grew up, you know, in Worcester, Massachusetts. There was plenty of, you know, sort of homophobia. There was all kinds of stuff. I don't know what the term transgender, I didn't know what that term meant, probably even when I went to college in the mid 70s. So, you know, I'm at somewhat loose ends in attempting to understand this stuff.
I don't have the analysis yet of that. I mean, the connections.
Okay. Well, your chapter.
But what I'd point out to you is the studies of Generation Z that psychologists Gene Twenge, Jonathan Haidt, and people like that have conducted, showing this just rash of mental illness, within among teens and young people in the last 10, starting about 2012. They attribute a lot of it to smartphones, but leaving that aside, and leaving aside what mental illness itself, I think that there is this kind of frenzied quest for identity among young people. And if you look at the transgender issue now, the single biggest group that is seeking to change their sexual identity are teenage girls. And they're not kids who, you know, when they were 4 years old, decided that they were different sex. And it's almost invariably, and this is, I'm relying on the European studies, accompanied by some kind of autism, depression, some kind of mental problem. So there is this really strange phenomenon going on among young people to some extent, I think, is really being exploited by some of the lobbies and some of the professional trade associations into a politics, into an ideological politics, but that should be a concern to us. I mean, it's just, I don't think the solution to that is to find new surgical forms of changing sexes among minors. That's not the, I think that, you know, therapy is a much better direction.
Yeah, I mean, back to the shadow party. I mean, nothing has taken over the shadow party of the Democrats faster than trans issues. You look 10 years ago and you look today. I mean, it's uniform across nonprofit organizations, advocacy groups, activists, academics. I mean, you name it. They're all 100% with sort of the trans program. And I would very much distinguish between what we might properly call trans rights, which is to not be discriminated against in employment and what have you, and what has become trans rights, which has become collapsed or melded together with a whole variety of things that have nothing to do with rights, like your acceptance of trans ideology, trans women are women, sex is a matter of identification, biological sex is a spectrum, you're whatever you identify with. And critically, that kids who say they're a different sex than their biological sex should, without many questions asked, be moved into medical treatment, puberty blockers, hormones, eventually surgery. This is a massive, massive move, this so-called gender-affirming care, which has nothing to do with rights. This is a policy issue. I mean, is this a good way to treat kids? Does this work? Why are we doing this? And in European countries, increasingly, we've seen people pulling back from this. And there's a fantastic article on the Free Press by this Finnish psychiatrist who was the one who basically started the gender clinic in Finland, and how, you know, things evolved over time as they looked at the data and they saw what was going on. And they basically, after a certain point, just not exactly stopped doing it, but they basically moved it into being an experimental treatment that, you know, outcomes are not clear. We should be very careful about how we do this, which is the exact opposite of what we have in the United States, where the leading medical organizations, which are really trade associations, not scientific bodies, have all endorsed the so-called gender affirming care as the Biden administration has. So this is really quite amazing. And it does, you know, sort of this very strange, you know, quick development of both the shadow party and the sort of official positions of the Democrats on this issue.
Yeah, well, just as an example of how this is playing out sort of in the here and now in our politics, a headline in today's Wall Street Journal on page 3, LGBT issues galvanize Democrats' school board push. And it's from Plumstead Township, Pennsylvania.
It's Bucks County, right?
Yeah, well, at stake is the control of the Central Bucks School District, Pennsylvania's third largest with more than 17,000 students. Candidates are at odds over a 2022 policy allowing parents to challenge school library books with sexual content, and one adopted this year barring teachers from advocating, quote, any partisan, political, or social policy issue, including by displaying objects such as rainbow, gay pride flags. And some of these books engage this, you know, they're talking about titles like Gender Queer, book is gay. Both titles were removed by the district after being challenged under this policy. And we have a Democratic candidate saying that I've been knocking on a lot of doors, talking to a lot of people, and potential voters are like, yeah, my 8-year-old son went by and got the mail and they, you know, saw this kind of stuff. So, you know, here we are in the heart of a battleground state where the Wall Street Journal thinks it's, you know, this is important enough to put it on, you know, page A3 of the front section. So everyone seems to think there's something, you know, playing out here.
It's nuts on both sides. I would think. I mean, I'm not. I mean, I, you know, on the one hand, right wingers wanting to get the books out of the libraries. That's again. That's just book banning. We know about that stuff, and it's applies to both books about race and books about homosexuality and whatever.
But wait a minute. Do you think genderqueer should be in school libraries, like, you know, your kid's elementary school library? I mean, there are limits. I mean, there's curation of books that go into libraries, right? So why is it a bad idea not to put genderqueer?
Well, sometimes
in school
it's
libraries?
Public libraries they're talking about. They're not.
Well, that's a different
about
issue.
School libraries.
That's a different issue.
Yeah, I mean, again, I guess I'd say that again, if teachers are going to teach that to kids, if they're going to read those things, then it becomes more of an issue, especially if they're promulgating a certain ideology, then I think it's an issue. But that's again, I don't think that's solved just by banning one way or another.
Right. Well, I guess the question in my mind is, and this relates to a larger question, is how do these, you know, how does the shadow party kind of resolve itself? I mean, does a vanguard essentially become, you know, the reigning power? You know, how do shadow parties how do they end? I mean, where do we see a determination? And your book, you know, it does, obviously this book seems to me like it's written for readers who you want them to, and maybe particularly Democratic readers, you want them to grasp this issue, you want to shed light on this issue. But as far as a fix is concerned, I mean, does history sort of fix this question of, you know, vanguards and how far they can go?
It's very hard. And let's say that Biden didn't take a view of transgender rights as the great civil rights issue of the era. Now, Reagan probably was very scared. I mean, Ronald Reagan was the first governor to sign something allowing abortion rights in America when he was in California. But he comes into office, and Moral Majority is one of his big backers, and he puts somebody as an assistant secretary or a deputy assistant secretary who's from the religious right, and you never hear about the person except, you know, among a few publications that either praise the person or condemn the person. Biden puts Rachel Franklin as assistant secretary of education, or nobody, or health. No, she's a health and human service.
I thought it was Levine, but anyway, yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
I'm not
sorry.
Sure.
But if you have now, you have the internet, you have social media, and it becomes a major issue and becomes identified with the party. And so it's very hard to break that identification. I mean, one of the complaints about criticisms of our book is, well, you know, if the Democrats repudiate all these ideas, then are they going to lose all these people? And basically, I think, you know, there has to be a time and a reckoning. And it usually comes when a party gets drubbed at the polls, where people realize that these have to be secondary issues and that the party itself has to be defined and defined clearly on issues of class, the common man and woman, and can't be identified clearly with all these, you know, extreme positions on social issues. But we're not there yet by any means.
Yeah, put another way, I think you can make the case right now that, in fact, you know, as I've argued, the progressive left is kind of a paper tiger. There's a whole series of positions that Democrats are told they have to hold. Otherwise, the base of the party will defect and they'll lose more voters than they'll gain. I think that's a highly questionable assertion, and I actually don't believe it, and I've made arguments empirically based to that effect. But I think John is right that, you know, just because that's a, you know, good analysis right now, and you can make a very strong case for it, doesn't mean the party can move in that direction very decisively at the current time, precisely because it is so dominated by the shadow parties, precisely because they haven't yet got their ass kicked because of this. So you do need a shock to the system, probably, to loosen the hold of the shadow party and its priorities on the Democrats. And that, you know, we don't venture any predictions in the book about how and why that'll happen, but I think that's probably what does need to happen. You know, how exactly to fix the Democrats in a very concrete way is above our pay grade. And we're just trying to point out what's going on.
Yeah. Well, okay. And as I think we can move to wrap up, I mean, there is an element here we haven't addressed, which is you have your clearly have as sympathies as kind of labor Democrats, if I can say that. And recently we did see United States President Joe Biden walk a picket line with the auto workers, dead auto workers. And that was a significant event. I don't know that presidents have done that before. And we also saw, you know, through this collective bargaining that the UAW got a meaningful pay raises and a good package. Does that seem like the kind of thing that you know, can build up more of a kind of muscular appeal to the voters that have been defecting from the Democratic Party?
Labor movement was crucial to the Democrats and was crucial to their appeal to the common man and woman or forgotten American. And it could be crucial again, but they have a long way to go. I mean, the organizing in the service sector is really blocked by the kind of labor law that we have. You see that happening with Starbucks and Amazon. I mean, I don't think that any of those unions really have bargained collectively that won elections for Starbucks, because you can just hold these things up indefinitely. So in my view, the Democrats are going to have to win a kind of cloture-proof majority again. Mm-hmm. And this time, unlike in 1993
in the Senate,
or 2009, they're going to have to change our labor laws to make it easier for unions to organize. In the absence of that, it's going to be very hard to go beyond what the UAW was just completely commendable, but they, again, didn't increase their ranks. They did very well by the people who they had already organized.
Right.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, I think that point is crucial about the cloture-proof majority. I mean, basically, you're talking about what is the Democrats' 60 Senate seat strategy? And if you start thinking about how the Democrats can possibly get 60 Senate seats, you very quickly run into the question of how can the Democrats be competitive in a lot of the states where they currently that are, you know, purple slash red. Or even reddish, if they continue on their current course or their current image and brand and so on, and the issues that they choose to prioritize. I mean, it doesn't really compute. So, you know, in a way, that's something that should lead the Democrats to want to decrease the influence of their shadow party and move to the center on some of these cultural issues and so on. Because if you really care about the labor movement, if you really care about that part of the Democrats' heritage and sort of potential strength, then you really do have to take seriously the idea of winning Senate seats in states where the Democrats currently don't look very competitive. So
right.
That's, I think, that should be a wake-up call, but it's what we'll see. I mean,
okay.
Maybe they still need that shock to the system that John's talking
right.
about.
Okay, well, on that not entirely hopeful note, I want to thank you, Roy, and John, for being on this podcast. And thank you, everyone. Welcome. This has been America and Beyond with Paul Starobin.